The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off today with Oprah's insider, Intention, Oprah on Taking Risks. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hi, everybody. Happy Sunday to you all. Today is a very special day for me because 38 years ago, the first episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show went on the air, and my life swerved in a whole new direction. That was the national version of the show. This anniversary has gotten me thinking back to that time in my life when I took that enormous risk and launched the show nationally. So many people were telling me that going to Chicago was a landmine. Even my father was like, "You can't leave that job in Baltimore. You're never going to make money like that." But there was something inside me driving me forward. I felt that I was supposed to take the risk, and I knew that if I didn't try, I'd never know what was possible. And recently, I was thinking about that when I was rereading Familiaris, David Robleski's book. There's a part where an old man tells the protagonist, "If you're going to go after something genuinely good, you got to get stronger. The thing is, it's going to take the best of you, but if you don't try, there won't be the best of you." I was moved by that because it resonated, and it's so true. If you don't try, you'll never know the best of you. And I'm proud of myself for trying and reaching a potential I didn't even know was there. This week, I want you to think about a time when you took a risk that unlocked the best of you. Have you ever done something against everybody else's idea of what you should do, and your life took on a different course? Let me know. Always a joy to hear from you all, and have a very peaceful week. Go well. We're on the word of the week. Somatic therapy. An excellent reason to book that massage ASAP. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Somatic therapy. Have you ever walked out of a massage and felt like an emotional weight had been lifted? Somatic, which means body, therapy is based on the brain-body connection and the idea that our bodies hold on to trauma and difficult feelings. Unresolved, deep-seated emotional pain can feel like physical pain if left untouched, and can manifest in anything from disrupted sleep and teeth grinding, the jaw ache, to muscle tension and shallow breathing. The bottom line is you really don't want to let that trauma stay buried. Somatic work is best done with a trained practitioner, especially the more complex forms, like eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, something Oprah and Prince Harry once spoke about. Finding a provider is easier than you think, but if you want to explore some simple methods on your own, check out our breathwork class or try EFT tapping, a practice that involves tapping different body points to release stress and negative emotions. Even a sustained hug can do wonders. Another great starting point is The Body Keeps the Score, basically the handbook on the subject. By incorporating techniques such as breathwork, movement, and touch, somatic therapy aims to enhance self-awareness, regulate emotions, and ultimately integrate experiences to a point of balance and resolution, says Rebecca Case, a social worker who practices mind-body techniques and author of polyvagal informed EMDR. Now that sounds like the magic touch. From the relationships section, parenting expert Dr. Becky Kennedy is launching a new book for kids. In her debut children's book, That's My Truck, Kennedy encourages parents and kids to talk about big feelings in a safe space. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Dr. Becky Kennedy, the renowned parenting expert and founder of Good Inside, brings her compassionate and science-backed insights to her debut children's book, That's My Truck. In this illustrated story, she helps children and parents navigate some of the bigger and tougher emotions. We sat down with Dr. Becky to discuss the inspiration behind her book, some top parenting tips, and the new Good Inside app. Why do kids hit? What are some underlying reasons? Why do kids engage in any bad behavior? It's the same reason why adults engage in bad behavior. Kids are born with all of the feelings and none of the skills to manage those feelings. In life, when our feelings overpower our skills, those feelings convert and explode out of our body as bad behavior. Kids are born with jealousy, with wanting things, with frustration. The feeling is not a problem. The only problem is if you don't have a skill to match it. I think the goal of parenting is to teach them those skills. Is there a wrong way to approach this sort of behavior? What we wanted to embody in the parent is what we call sturdy leadership. It's the same thing as a sturdy pilot when you're in turbulence. You want a pilot who knows what they're doing. When I think about the mom in That's My Truck, she shows up as very sturdy. First of all, she sets a boundary. Then she sees the feeling that's underneath the behavior and she validates. That combination of boundaries plus empathy is what we call sturdy parenting. They both matter. It's not effective when you do one without the other. We step in harshly, but we forget there is a feeling that's real and valid underneath the behavior. Or we only validate the feeling without setting the boundary. I would say your job description as a parent is to be a sturdy leader by providing boundaries and empathizing with our kids' inevitable emotional reactions to our boundaries. There's a little wash, rinse, and repeat here. In that way, I find it comforting because I don't have to learn a million things over and over. What inspired you to write your book? Books are powerful tools for connection and for learning. I think with That's My Truck, I was aiming not just to create an engaging story, but an opportunity for connection and skill building. The best time to help our kids build skills is when they feel safe and connected to us. To me, the book is a medium to feel both like you're connecting with your kid and you're teaching them important skills that they need to learn. Kids who have problem behaviors are some of the most misunderstood kids in the world. That's something I feel very passionately about protecting kids from. I want to help a kid who's reading the book to see that they're a good kid who's having a hard time, not a bad kid doing bad things. I also want to help a parent see the good kid who is under the bad behavior. When both of those things happen, there's a profound impact on a family. And you don't just have a book, but a new app, too. For the past 2 years, we've built this online library with scripts for hard moments, skill-building workshops, plus on-the-go, quick videos and articles they could read. We have this amazing global community of parents who are incredibly active and engaged in our membership. We have members from over 100 countries, but so many parents have no more than 2 minutes at a time. They want to watch a workshop. They want to engage. Yet they end up feeling like failures because their life is too hectic. I wanted them to have something in their pocket for parenting, something that makes it possible to learn something new, to be more connected to your kid, and to bring more peace to your home when you just have 2 minutes. The Good Inside app gives parents instant access to exactly what they need in the moment they need it, which means when it's bedtime and your kid's protesting and you feel yourself about to yell when you don't want to, you just go to the app and we give the exact words to say. The whole rest of the night goes better and you go to bed feeling like a rock star parent because you had this 24/7 parent coach in your pocket. That's what we wanted to do, and now it's out there. We launched less than a month ago, and we have 2,000 five-star reviews in the App Store. Do you have a favorite feature? I have so many. I love our AI chatbot. It's been trained on my entire content library. I feel like it's even better than the advice or text responses I would have sent to my friends. I also love this new feature called Daily Decks. You get 5 cards. You swipe through them, and they give you the exact insight you need for the problem you're facing. It's all our best content from the workshops broken up into these under 5-minute-a-day decks. The last thing I love is these reminders. There are certain moments in my day that are so chaotic that I need someone to whisper something in my ear. I need an emotional reset. We actually do that in the app. We know the message we believe parents need to hear based on the problem they're going through. Maybe it's sleep, or tantrums, or deeply feeling kids. We send you a reminder that feels like magic. It's just the thing parents need to get grounded and more forward in a helpful direction. Even though I'm not a parent, could I still learn from it? Everything in our app is personalized to the age of your kids, so you know the examples and the advice is developmentally appropriate for the stage your kid is at. Having said that, we've had plenty of adults who don't have kids who say, "I input my own name and the age I was when I felt like I didn't exactly get what I needed." I use this for my inner child reparenting journey, and I think that is so incredible. So the book that accompanies this article, again, the title is That's My Truck by Dr. Becky Kennedy. And it's $12 at Macmillan.com if you're interested in purchasing it. We're over in the books section. Read the sneak peek of Oprah's 107th book club pick. In Tell Me Everything, two of Elizabeth Strout's most iconic characters, Olive Kitteridge and Lucy Barton, finally cross paths. This article is by Elizabeth Strout. A thought had taken hold of Olive Kitteridge on one of these days in October, and she pondered it for almost a week before she called Bob Burgess. I have a story to tell that writer Lucy Barton. I wish you would have her come visit me. The story was one that Olive had been reflecting on with more and more frequency, and she thought, as people often do, that if her story could be told to a writer, maybe it could be used in a book one day. Olive did not know if Lucy was a famous writer or not, quite a famous writer, but she decided it did not matter. The library always had a long wait list for Lucy's books, so Olive had ordered them from the bookstore instead, and she read through them. And something made her think that this Lucy might like, or could possibly use, the story Olive had to tell. So, on this particular autumn day, the yellow leaves of the trees seen through Olive's large windowed back doorway were quivering to the ground as she waited for Lucy Barton to show up. Olive, sitting in her wing-back chair, saw two chickadees and a titmouse at her feeder. She leaned forward and spotted a squirrel. Olive rapped her knuckles against the window hard, and the squirrel scurried away. "Ha!" said Olive, sitting back. She hated squirrels. They ate her flowers, and they were always bothering her birds. Olive found her glasses on the small table next to her and picked up her big cordless phone, which was also on the table, and pressed some numbers on it. "Isabel," said Olive, I can't come visit you this morning. I'm having a visitor. I'll tell you all about it when I come see you this afternoon. Bye now. Olive clicked the phone off and looked around her small apartment. She tried to imagine the place through the writer's eyes, and Olive decided it was all right. It was neat and not cluttered with hideous knick-knacks the way so many old people had in their homes. Tabletops crowded with photographs of their grandchildren. Such foolishness. Olive had 4 grandchildren, but she only had a photograph of one of them in her bedroom, a small photo of little Henry, who was not so little anymore. And in the living room, on her hutch, she kept a large photograph of her first husband, Henry, and that was enough. She looked at it now and said, "Well, Henry, we'll see if she's responsive." At 10:05, there was a light knock on her door that faced the hallway, and Olive yelled out, "Come in!" In stepped a small woman who looked meek and mousy. Olive could not stand meek and mousy-looking people. The woman said, "I'm sorry, I'm early. I'm always early. I can't seem to help it." "That's fine. I hate people who are late. Sit down," Olive said, and she nodded toward the small couch against the wall across from her. Lucy Barton came in and sat down. She was wearing a blue and black plaid coat that went to her knees and jeans that Olive thought were too tight for a woman her age. Lucy was 66. Olive had looked it up. The sofa was a stiff one. Olive knew this. But the woman somehow, the way she sat on it, made it appear even stiffer. And she had the strangest things on her feet. Boots with long, big silver zippers right up the front of them. Olive could see the small ankles and the tight pants that were tucked into them. "Take your coat off," Olive said.
"No, thank you. I get cold easily."
Olive rolled her eyes. "I would hardly say it's cold in here." Olive was disappointed in this creature. A silence fell into the room, and Olive let it sit there. Finally, Lucy Barton said,
"Well, it's nice to meet you."
"Eh, yeah," was all Olive said, swinging one foot back and forth. There was something odd about this woman. She wore no glasses, and her eyes were not small, but she had a slightly stunned look on her face. "What are those things you've got on your feet?" Olive asked. The woman looked down at them, sticking her toe straight up.
"Oh, they're boots. We went to Rockland last summer, and I found these in a store."
Rockland. Money. Of course, Olive thought. She said, "There's no snow on the ground. Don't know why you need boots." The woman closed her eyes for a long moment, and when she opened them, she did not look at Olive. "So I hear you're with us in town to stay," Olive said.
"Who told you that?"
The woman asked this as though really curious to know the answer, and she continued to look slightly bewildered. "Bob Burgess." And then the woman's face changed. It became gentle, relaxed for a moment.
"Right,"
she said. Olive took a breath and said, "Well, Lucy, how are you liking our little town of Crosby?"
"It's quite a change," Lucy Barton said.
"Well, it's not New York, if that's what you mean." Lucy looked around the room and then said,
"I guess that is what I mean."
Olive continued to watch her. For a few moments, there was only the ticking of the grandfather clock and the slight whirring sound of the refrigerator in the alcove kitchen.
"You told Bob that you had a story to tell me," Lucy asked.
She slipped off her coat then, letting it stay on her back, and Olive saw a black turtleneck. Skinny. The creature was skinny, but her eyes were watching Olive now with a keenness. Olive swung an arm lightly toward the stack of books on the bottom shelf of the small table beside her. "I've read all your books." Lucy Barton did not seem to have any response to this, though her eyes briefly dropped down to the books on the shelf. Olive said, "I thought your memoirs were a little self-pitying myself. You're not the only person to come from poverty." Lucy Barton again seemed to have no response to this. Olive said, "And how does your ex-husband William feel being written about?
I'm curious to know.
Lucy gave a small shrug.
He's okay with it. He knows I'm a writer.
I see. Olive added. And now you're back with him, together again, but not married?
That's right.
In Crosby, Maine?
That's right.
Again, there was a silence. Then Olive said, You don't look a bit like your photograph on your books.
I know, Lucy said it simply and gave a shrug.
Why is that? Olive said.
Because some professional photographer took it, and also my hair isn't really blonde anymore. That photo was taken years ago.
Lucy put her hand through her hair, which was chin-length and pale brown. Well, it was too blonde in the photo, Olive said. A sudden slant of sunlight came through the window and fell across the wooden floor. The grandfather clock in the corner kept on with its ticking. Lucy reached behind her and took her coat and placed it on the couch next to her. That's my husband, said Olive, pointing to the large photograph on the hutch. My first husband, Henry. Wonderful man.
He looks nice, Lucy said. Tell me the story. Bob said you had a story you wanted me to hear.
She said this kindly.
I'd like to hear it. I really would.
Bob Burgess is a good fellow. I've always liked him, Olive said.
Lucy's face got pink. This is what Olive thought she saw. Bob is the best friend I have in this town. He's maybe the best friend I've had ever.
Her eyes dropped to the floor as she said this, but then she looked up at Olive and said,
Please tell me the story.
Something in Olive relaxed. She said, Okay, but now I don't know if it's worth telling.
Well, tell me anyway, Lucy said.
So the book that goes with this article is Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strout. It's $23 at Amazon, $28 at bookshop.org, and $23 at thriftbooks.com. Over at Holness, we have an article, Inner Peace During This Election Cycle? Yes, you can. A national mental wellness campaign. Meditate America is here to save your sanity. This article is by Jenny Tung. If your daily intake of headlines, news clips, and political podcasts has you vibrating with anxiety, there's a name for your malaise. Election stress disorder, a term first used in, you guessed it, 2016. This time around, there's relief in sight. Meditate America, a national campaign created by the David Lynch Foundation, kicks off today. You can stream the launch event, co-hosted by Hugh Jackman, at 7:45 p.m. ET, here. Lynch, the legendary Twin Peaks director, started the foundation in 2005 to offer widespread access to Transcendental Meditation, TM. A practice brought to the U.S. from India in the late 1950s by the spiritual leader Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. From now through November 15, the organization is offering free online introduction sessions and up to 50% off TM lessons for stressed-out Americans across 100-plus cities. For details and locations, go to tm.org. The campaign has a second, more systemic purpose, partnering with research universities including Columbia, Stanford, and the University of Southern California to conduct clinical trials on the effects of TM on brain health, so it can be prescribed as a medical treatment and covered by insurance. We expect this to happen in 3 or 4 years, says tonight's other host, Bob Roth, CEO of the Foundation's Institute for Mental Health and Resilience, and a longtime instructor whose students include Oprah, Jerry Seinfeld, Martin Scorsese, and Maria Shriver. We're in a stress pandemic, and there are no conventional interventions that address the root cause of chronic stress.
We asked Roth about the power of meditation, the mission of the campaign, and how to calm down the next time a Siena poll spikes your blood pressure. How would you sum up the goals of Meditate America? 1, it's a campaign to raise people's awareness about meditation in general. Just like there are good medicines and not good medicines, there are effective meditations and there are rip-offs. The second thing we're doing is phase 3 clinical trials with top universities. Most studies on meditation or yoga are small. We want to do them on a large scale with 500 to 1,000 people and 4 or 5 different hospitals, so TM can be included in the healthcare system. Say a single mom suffers from high levels of anxiety, she could see her family physician and the physician could write a prescription for an anti-anxiety medication and write out a prescription for transcendental meditation, and both would be reimbursed because TM has met the high levels of rigorous research that merits that kind of inclusion. How would you explain TM to someone who's never heard of it? Imagine the cross-section of an ocean. We have waves on the surface, and the ocean is quiet at its depth. And the surface is the thinking mind. Cognitive approaches to meditation, like focused attention or open monitoring meditation, are attempts to modulate and minimize thoughts, feelings, and moods to address them on the surface. Transcendental meditation gives you access to go deep within. Like an ocean has a vertical dimension, the mind has a vertical dimension. And deep within every human being, right now, every one of us has within us a level where the mind is already settled. It's peaceful, wide awake. Transcendental meditation is like a gentle settling down to experience your own quiet innermost self. And when you do that, the brainwave activity is completely different than with any other form of meditation. How can people learn and experience this? Meditate America is being launched in 150 cities. There's Meditate Fresno, Meditate Boston, Meditate Miami, Meditate Biloxi, so they can contact their local TM centers. It's a non-profit organization, so instruction costs will be reduced by half during the campaign, and if a person doesn't have any money, then they're working on local donations so everyone has access to it. The thing about TM is that you get your own teacher. You learn from human being to human being, and your teacher follows up with you for the rest of your life. TM involves 20 minutes of meditation, repeating your mantra twice a day. Are there any quick things you suggest doing in a moment of anxiety? I know a lot of athletes, before they go out on the pitcher's mound or something, they breathe in through their nose, hold it for 3 or 4 seconds, and then exhale through the lips and hold it for 3 or 4 seconds, and they do that 10 times. Some simple deep breathing for a minute or two can bring your vagus nerve and therefore your whole body into balance. After your 50-plus years of teaching TM, what is one thing you know for sure? You have to be true to yourself, and to be true to yourself, you have to know yourself. You have to meditate or do things that reveal your innermost truth that no one else could know about you, and then do what you know to be right, and don't do what you know to be wrong. Our next article is in Relationships. Why divorce at 60 was the best thing that ever happened to me. Starting over late in life felt impossible until I realized I was the architect of my future. By Stephen Petro. 6 springs ago, I officially joined the singles crowd when my ex-husband forwarded an email from his attorney with the subject line, "You are divorced." I'll admit it seemed excessively jubilant, especially in light of the harshness of the final decree, which read, "The bonds of matrimony which have existed between the parties are dissolved and the plaintiff is granted an absolute divorce from the defendant." There I was at age 60, yet again identified as, take your pick, solo, unmarried, unattached, unwed, or alone. No matter what anyone called it, I was single. When I bought my post-divorce house, the title company listed me as a single man, which felt like a badge of shame, a red letter S for Stephen and single, affixed to my chest. No matter where I turned, I couldn't avoid the question, "What is your marital status?" It leered at me from my medical chart. Financial disclosure forms, social security documents, loan and credit applications, a new health club registration, marketing questionnaires, certain vital records, the U.S. Census, and, no surprise, online dating apps, where I've learned a good percentage of men lie about everything from their marital status to their height, weight, and most of all, age. As if that weren't sufficient, there always comes the inevitable next question, why? As in, why are you single? Something no one should ever ask. Implicit in that seemingly simple query is a more odious one. What's the matter with you? Look, I'd not expected to be single as a sexgenarian. Actually, I believed what we'd recited in our marriage vows. You know the line, until death do us part. My answer to long-term care insurance or whether to sign up for a retirement community? A husband. Ditto when it came to a travel companion or someone to share household expenses. We live in a culture that tends to celebrate and exalt couples, writes Catherine Gray in The Unexpected Joy of Being Single. But pigeonholes singles as outliers, misfits, oddballs who can't find someone to love them. Of course, there are other fail-safes that are now no more. Who to ferry me to the doctor in an emergency, who to help with buying a house, and who to go to bed with on a regular, even irregular, basis. Still, I can eat whatever I want, whenever I want. I've learned a lot since those early days of my newly single life. It's easy to feel alone when you're single, but we're not. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that more than 126 million Americans age 18 and older are single, a number that's growing. There's a distinction between being alone and being lonely, and I admit I'm exuberantly happy not to share a bathroom and a bed, or to be in a relationship that included my mother-in-law, echoing what the late Princess Diana once bemoaned, "There were three of us in the marriage." As it turns out, new studies are shedding fresh light on that old myth about marrieds being healthier and happier. In fact, unmarried people, singles, tend to enjoy greater health and well-being than their partnered counterparts. If you're unpartnered, you're much more likely to exercise regularly, even if or because you're doing it to keep in shape to attract someone new. Single women have been found to have lower BMIs and fewer risks associated with smoking and alcohol than married women, according to a study published in the Journal of Women's Health. Oh, and this should come as no surprise. Singles have more sex more often than married people, and more sex is associated with greater well-being or joy. In fact, single, child-free women are the happiest of all demographics, according to Paul Doland, a professor of behavioral science at the prestigious London School of Economics and the author of Happy Ever After. He attributes their joy, in part, to extremely close friendships, while a study published in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships concludes that being single boosts social connections because uncoupled people are more likely to rely on their social and professional networks than their married or partnered friends. Yep, that sounds about right. Still, as I approached 60, two specific fears kept me awake at night and anxious by day. How would I celebrate this milestone birthday? My parents had thrown my 50th celebration. I'd expected my husband to do the honors this time around. When two couples in my small town realized I had no plans, they asked if they could throw me a party. I replied, yes, which honestly wasn't so easy, because it required a big mind shift to lean into my friendships. On the other hand, I had no plan B. The first clue to what awaited me arrived in my inbox. The invitation boasted a fiery wreath. The theme, Disco Inferno. Red and white attire was suggested, plus a heated spirit. The night of the party, I arrived in my friend's backyard, only to be greeted by a life-size cardboard cutout of me. The organizing committee had taken it up a notch further, rewriting the lyrics of Hello Dolly to Hello Petro, which a dozen friends sang to me as I joyfully wept. In a short speech, I confessed to everyone that my marital separation had left me fearful of two things. What to do on this birthday? Check. And who would drive me to my next colonoscopy? A friend raised his hand at that very moment. A day that I had dreaded became one of the most beautiful evenings I'd experienced, thanks to these friends who were becoming my family of choice. Perhaps single wasn't so bad after all. Jamie Daniel Farrell, who specializes in marriage counseling and what she calls divorce recovery, noted much the same in her personal and professional life, writing, "If you're brave enough to let your story be known, others going through a similar experience will come out of the woodwork and be drawn to you. Genuinely supportive friendships can form. This," she said, "can help with feelings of loneliness and isolation, and I say it can change your life." I wondered what other joys people found in being unattached. So, naturally, I asked friends on Facebook. I sure got an earful. "I don't have to shave my legs if I don't want to. I can play whatever music I want. I can drink milk out of the carton and not worry about getting caught. Sleeping on either side of the bed, or even sideways. Traveling the world with friends. Not worrying about my partner snoring and not caring whether I do. No one to answer to about money. A body pillow that doesn't complain about being hugged. I can play the piano at 6 a.m. No more negotiation over what to watch on TV. No more bickering. Not having to cook dinner even if it's my turn. Not having to pull someone else's hair out of the drain. Not being judged." I'm not arguing that it's necessarily better to be single than partnered or married, but half a decade after divorce and still single, I get to eat what I want, when I want. I decide where to put the art in my house, and my vacations are no longer a ménage à trois. I love what Catherine Gray writes. Singles are not half people. We are full people and perfectly complete the way we are. I've also rediscovered two of my greatest joys, tennis and canoeing, which conveniently reminds me of what the never-married Louisa May Alcott once famously wrote, "I'd rather be a free spinster and paddle my own canoe." There's a book that accompanies this article, The Joy You Make, Find the Silver Linings Even on Your Darkest Days. And the book is by Stephen Petro, last name is spelled P-E-T-R-O-W, and it's $27 at Bookshop. The next article is from Work and Money. How many credit cards do you really need? Turns out there are very good reasons to have more than one. Here's what you need to know. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. It's a well-worn joke, but it holds true. Years after finishing school, I can tell you that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell, but I have zero clue how to manage my credit score. And that's why, as a non-married, childless person in my upper 20s, I have but one credit card. Maybe you find that shocking, or maybe, like me, you don't get why people need multiple cards. Or more likely, you have a few, but you really don't know if they're the right or most optimal ones. Plus, you're stymied by the options and jargon, from annual fees and APR to points and cash back, and you're never quite sure how your friends are upgrading to business class with miles and accessing airport lounges for free. To clear it all up, we asked experts our most basic and potentially embarrassing questions, so you fellow grown-ups don't have to. Does having one credit card mean I'm not a real adult? No, you're not in financial dire straits if you never graduated from your first card, explains Sofia Figueroa, and that's Figueroa, a certified financial planner at Elevest. The most important thing is responsible credit management. With it, which is possible with just one card, she says. This advice rings especially true if you're at a less advanced life stage or truly have fewer financial responsibilities to wrangle. Credit management is essentially maintaining a good credit score, which is calculated from a variety of financial factors. Your payment history, aka how often you've paid your cards on time, accounts for 35% of your score, says Ashley Feinstein Gerstley, Gerstley, the certified financial planner behind The Fiscal Femme and author of Financial Adulting. So, having one card and paying it off every month is a solid start. Another 15% of your score, Gerstley says, comes from the length of your credit history. That means building a long relationship with your cards is also crucial, so you should never close one you've had for a long time. So why bother having more than one card? To build even better credit. Let's say you're in a life stage where your spending has ballooned, planning a wedding, raising kids, or you want to boost your credit score to help with a future mortgage or to secure a loan to start a business. Having more than one credit card can set you up for success, as long as you trust yourself to pay each card responsibly. More on that later. An excellent credit score, according to Equifax, is 800 to 850, while very good ones are 740 to 799, and good scores fall between 670 to 739. Equifax and the other credit bureaus, TransUnion and Experian, the companies that calculate the number, like to see action, say multiple on-time card and loan payments, so your credit score will likely increase if you have more than one card you pay off monthly. That also means your score can really only get so high with just one card, because using less credit means less data to determine your score. Lenders like to see that someone can manage multiple credit accounts, says Figueroa. If you've been avoiding it, get a free credit report here, and you can do it once a year through the government. You might also be able to check your score through your credit card company. Another variable in your score is credit utilization. That's the percentage of each card you're using, Gerstley says. You want to be using a small percentage of your credit limit. For instance, if your credit limit on a card is $5,000 and you're putting $3,000 on it every month, your credit utilization rate is 60%, which is high. The ideal rate is below 30%. The lower, the better, says Figueroa. Translation, it's better for your credit score to spread spending across several cards and to leave a healthy gap between your monthly balances, which you should pay in full to avoid interest fees and the slippery slope of credit card debt and the credit limit. All the cards seem different, but the same. How do I choose? Another reason I've stuck with one card? All the choices out there give me sheer overwhelm. But since I spend an arm and a leg on restaurants and shows most months, I'd benefit from finding a card that offers a higher percentage of cash back, 3 to 5% ideally, on dining out and entertainment. Chase Freedom Unlimited is a good go-to. If I traveled as much as I'd like to, a travel card. Chase Sapphire and Capital One Venture are primo. Would earn me more miles and points when I book hotels, rental cars, and flights. Eventually, I could turn those miles and points into freebies. All these rewards are accessible within your online account, where you can choose whether to get cash back or use your points towards said freebies. Cards with an annual fee typically have the sexiest perks, but they're only worth it if you truly take advantage and can afford the $95 to $700 fee, Figueroa says. If you get a free checked bag on every flight or a substantial credit for streaming services, something you previously spent a ton on, great. But if you fly only once a year, think again. It's up to you to do the specific math, unfortunately. By the way, Gertzley suggests contacting credit card companies and trying to negotiate annual fees. Sometimes companies will give you a free year or a lower rate. You'll never know until you straight up ask. How many cards is too many? Generally, experts recommend 2 to 3 cards, depending on your situation. But if opening a new credit card means you'll ramp up your shopping addiction, don't do it. Same for playing the points game. Spending beyond your means just to access an airport lounge once a year is never a good idea. You'll know this when it becomes difficult to maintain your budget or you're at risk of missing payments, Figueroa says. Having more than one card may come with some benefits, but they get wiped out quickly if you fall behind on payments. Another important note, applying for a new credit card will temporarily lower your credit score. There'll be a hard inquiry made into your credit, like a flag for risk, Gertzley explains. That's why you shouldn't open a new card, say, 6 months before trying to buy a house. Your credit score should be as high as possible when you're applying for a mortgage. But if you continue to manage your credit after opening the new card, your score will bounce back within a few months to a year. And for the love of God, pay your bill on time, even if it's the minimum payment. Making a late payment lasts on your credit score for 7 years. We get the shame spiral of not being able to afford the full amount, but the whole point of a credit card is to defer or split payments when needed. Don't bury your head in the sand. Pay what you can, then pay the rest off when you can. But how can I remember to pay everything on time? Try a tactic both Figueroa and Gertzley recommended, retiring older cards. With this approach, you shift most of your credit card spending from the old to the new, Figueroa explains. This makes the most sense when opening a new card that has much better benefits. Make sure to keep a small, steady charge on the old card, though, something you can set and forget, like your recurring Netflix subscription, and turn on the auto pay function. Another strategy is to assign a specific purpose to each card, says Figueroa, but this one isn't for the faint of heart, i.e. the disorganized. You can either utilize different cards' specific benefits by designating one for dining out, one for groceries, one for travel, etc., or split cards into categories like fixed expenses. Utilities and subscriptions would be good on a general cashback card, and extracurricular spending, dining out, shopping for fun. Of course, this all means you need to keep better track of your bills so you don't go overboard. It also helps to literally jot down your specific perks, whether in a notebook or your Notes app, so you don't forget about that yearly free hotel room or Uber Eats gift card. Even a monthly or quarterly budget check-in can be a game-changer in managing your spending habits, Figueroa says. In culture and news, Princess Kate may make a rare public appearance with Prince William this fall. Kate will potentially join the royal family for this special event, according to a new report. This article is by Chelsea Sanchez. Princess Kate may join the rest of the royal family for a special public engagement this November. According to a new report by the Sunday Times, the Princess of Wales could potentially join husband Prince William and father-in-law King Charles III for the National Service of Remembrance amid her ongoing recovery from cancer. The annual ceremony, held at the Cenotaph in London on November 10 this year, honors the service and the lives lost of members of the British and Commonwealth military. It is also one of the more significant events on a working royal's calendar. The Times also reported that Kate's aides have begun planning royal carols together at Christmas, a televised carol service that has become one of the princess's tentpole events since she launched it in 2021. Kate has reportedly been continuing her royal work from home at Adelaide Cottage in Windsor. This includes taking regular meetings with her private secretary, Tom White, her assistant private secretary, Natalie Burrows, and the Wales's communications secretary, Lee Thompson. Kate has made very few public appearances since she announced her cancer diagnosis in March. Prior to her first official engagement of the year at June's Trooping the Color ceremony, she released a statement that addressed her health. "I am making good progress, but as anyone going through chemotherapy will know, there are good days and bad days," she said. "On those bad days, you feel weak, tired, and you have to give in to your body resting. But on the good days, when you feel stronger, you want to make the most of feeling well." The princess added, "I'm learning how to be patient, especially with uncertainty, taking each day as it comes, listening to my body, and allowing myself to take this much-needed time to heal." A month later, Kate made news again by stepping out with her daughter, Princess Charlotte, and sister, Pippa Matthews, to attend Wimbledon. While she hasn't made an official public appearance since, she did participate in a filmed video with Prince William to congratulate Team Great Britain on its Olympic wins last month. There is no information about Kate's return because the focus at this moment in time is 100% on her health. To suggest she won't return to her role is unfair and untrue, a Palace insider previously told Harper's Bazaar this past summer. Conversations of that nature are just not being had. When the time is right, she will resume her work. Still in culture and news, Taylor Swift endorses Kamala Harris in rare emotional statement. The pop singer's message came moments after the much-awaited debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. This article is by Rosa Sanchez. Taylor Swift is a billionaire. She has broken multiple records with her international Eras tour. She is in a loving relationship with Super Bowl champion Travis Kelce. And every outfit she wears, no matter how stylish, makes headlines in the world's most luxurious fashion magazines. But what true Swifties have always wanted from her is pure transparency. When will she speak out to tell her story? Where does she stand on the issues that matter to us? Today, finally, she has given us an answer. On Tuesday night, following the much-awaited debate between presidential and nominees Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, the lover singer shared a rare statement endorsing Democratic nominee Harris. It is the first time the pop star has publicly voiced her opinion on the 2024 election, and seeing as how a substantial part of her fandom stands with Trump, her efforts make a big statement. "Like many of you, I watched the debate tonight. If you haven't already, now is a great time to do your research on the issues at hand and the stances these candidates take on the topics that matter to you the most," she began in a statement posted on Instagram. Swift added that she was recently made aware of the AI images of herself falsely endorsing Trump that are being distributed online. "It really conjured up my fears around AI and the dangers of spreading misinformation. It brought me to the conclusion that I need to be very transparent about my actual plans for this election as a voter. The simplest way to combat misinformation is with the truth," she said. "I will be casting my vote for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in the 2024 presidential election. I am voting for @KamalaHarris because she fights for the rights and causes I believe need a warrior to champion them," Swift wrote. "I think she is a steady-handed, gifted leader, and I believe we can accomplish so much more in this country if we are led by calm and not chaos. I was so heartened and impressed by her selection of running mate @TimWalz, who has been standing up for LGBTQ+ rights, IVF, and a woman's right to her own body for decades." The singer added that she has done her research and made her choice, and she hopes others will follow. She signed her note with "Love and Hope, Taylor Swift, Childless Cat Lady," an ironic response to Trump running mate J.D. Vance's infamous degrading comments about childless cat ladies. In another article in Culture and News, Selena Gomez shares she can't carry her own children and will take different path to parenthood. This article is by Alyssa Bailey. Selena Gomez plans to start a family in the next few years, but her path to motherhood will be different from many people's. The singer recently opened up to Vanity Fair about her future plans and her relationship with Benny Blanco. Even before she started dating him, she was determined to have children by the age of 35. "Before I met my boyfriend, I was single for 5 years, with the exception of going on a few dates," she said. "And I was like, okay, this is the vibe. Then what is the most important thing to me? Family." She added, "I haven't ever said this, but I unfortunately can't carry my own children. I have a lot of medical issues that would put my life and the babies in jeopardy. That was something I had to grieve for a while." Gomez has been open about her journey with lupus, having a kidney transplant, and her experience treating her bipolar depression. In her November 2022 Rolling Stone interview, Gomez shared that the medications she takes might make her unable to have a safe pregnancy. Gomez has made peace with that and told Vanity Fair of becoming a parent someday. "It's not necessarily the way I envisioned it. I thought it would happen the way it happens for everyone. But I'm in a much better place with that. I find it a blessing that there are wonderful people willing to do surrogacy or adoption, which are both huge possibilities for me. It made me really thankful for the other outlets for people who are dying to be moms. I'm one of those people. I'm excited for what that journey will look like, but it'll look a little different. At the end of the day, I don't care. It'll be mine. It'll be my baby." As for her boyfriend, Gomez did not address engagement rumors, but said there is no pressure for her and Blanco to get married. "We always make sure we're protecting what we have, but there's no rules," she said. "I want him to always be himself. I always want to be myself," she added. "Even if she doesn't get married, I'm not changing my name no matter what. I am Selena Gomez. That's it." She kept comments on her relationship limited, but offered a little insight. "I've never been loved this way," she said of Blanco. "He's just been a light, a complete light in my life. He's my best friend. I love telling him everything." We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.